Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So our guest today has been described as one of the most important artists working across arts and health right now. His groundbreaking work has huge potential for impact across life sciences and is a testament to the power of creativity in health and well-being. So Justin Wiggins is here with us today, and his practice includes a range of media from sound, phonics, film, drawing, installation, interventions and performance, and he's collaborated with such a wide range of individuals across medical, research and creative industry sectors. His works have been exhibited nationally and internationally, and Justin, you've described your own aim as being to educate, share and engage people with sound and reconnect with their lives using sound art. Justin has extended his artistic practice to work with young people and community groups, particularly those associated with increased vulnerability, such as within palliative care and mental health. And finally, Justin runs Glass Twin, a company that uses sound as a tool to promote well-being through developing soundscapes. And he's worked within hospices, prison and schools, as well as with emergency services and charities supporting people with mental health needs. And it's within this company that you and I met, Justin, as you worked with us to try and find some ways to enrich the environment of the FENS unit and create meaningful use of sound. I have to say, Justin, before we start, that you really are one of the most innovative thinkers I've come across in terms of your approach to sound. So I don't quite know where the conversation's going to take us today, but really looking forward to hear what you might have to share with us today. So very much, big welcome to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you for asking me.
So, hi, Justin. It's really nice to meet. When Naomi was telling me about you and what you did and the kind of things that you create, I wasn't really quite sure. I didn't really understand what she was talking about or how that fitted in with our kind of overall brief. But having looked at some of your work and listened to some of it, I must say I've been really impressed. And at times I've been overwhelmed with emotion, because a lot of your work is extremely powerful and gets very directly to the kind of core of the quite painful issues that people are dealing with. Other times, of course, you talk to people about their childhood, and that's kind of different and powerful in a slightly different sense. So anyway, I just wanted to say that right at the beginning. So sound seems a less common sense for an artist to focus upon. I wonder if you could tell us how you became to be so appreciative of the value of sound.
Yeah, of course. So when I was about 5 years old, I had an incident which had a major impact on my life. But when it happened, I didn't realise how big or what shape that impact would be. And I guess it's equivalent of having a snowball and finding there's a rock inside it, and the snow melts and you see that there's some substance after something's melted away. That's the only way I can describe it. And the situation was, for some reason, and I don't know why, but I was called with my mum to see a doctor in the school. There'd been some previous tests, and the doctor, the specialist, announced that by my late teenage years, I would be completely blind. And as a small boy, to hear that, but coming from a specialist. So at that age, you put your entire trust in everything that comes out of a specialist's mouth, don't you? Because of that, there's this instant reaction. And as soon as I heard those words, I panicked and I ran. And I ran throughout the school, over the playing fields, and I continued to run with my mum screaming in the background, "Come back!" And tears just rolling down my eyes, thinking, how am I meant to understand this information? But because of that, and looking back on it and realize and seeing the rock other than the snow, that's what I'm holding now. I'm holding the rock from that snowball. I started to engage with a sense of sound as a backup for my eyesight ultimately failing and ending. So I would wake up in the morning or go to sleep at night with the hesitancy that in the morning I would not be able to see and everything would be completely black and cut off. And I guess partly as a survival thing and partly as it being intuitive, I started to train my ears and investigate my world through sound because of it. So I was kind of experimenting from an early age with capturing the sounds around me with the intent of training my mind and my ears to enhance my hearing so I could in the future navigate through the world by using just the sense of hearing. And I would do that in very playful ways. For example, I had a small shoebox tape recorder and I would fill hours and hours of just cassettes of just nonsense, just recording the radiator next to me or sounds around the house or putting it next to the radio player and editing out bits of sentences and playing, being quite creative with it. So that early way of capturing something, a survival mechanism, being playful with it, ended up me planting the seeds for the work that ultimately I do now. So yeah, that's the reason why I'm a sound artist. I wouldn't say it was because of circumstance, because you can choose circumstance, but it was a decision made early on, which has led me to see, though, realize the value of sound in terms of resilience and navigation.
You can really see that when you spoke about kind of capturing the radiator, for instance, it just reminded me of some of the interesting things that you've chosen to record the sound of in some of the work that you've done that I don't think would occur to other people to engage with acoustically.
Yeah, so I think because of developing this kind of way of mapping my environment through sound, of becoming at some points overly aware of microsounds and how important microsounds in your own environment register a kind of profile of who you are and where you live. So, for example, if you guys were to stay over at my house, then a certain time, around about 2:30, the fridge would make a certain sound. I know that sound, but you don't know that sound. And for me, that sound represents safety and being fed and all these things. But because of your unfamiliarity with that sound, you might think that the back door is being broken into. So that connection of sound and locality and environment is really, really important, especially those micro sounds, which have, I think, a psychological benefit in understanding the tiny sounds compared with the big sounds.
That's fascinating, and it's an amazing account, really, of how something that was actually quite traumatic, you've managed to process and turn into, you know, an activity which is the opposite, really, highly creative. How did you build upon that initial development that you've just described to us?
Well, I think the realization that I had the power to make an alternative early on was aided by a curiosity or a fearlessness of curiosity and use by any means possible to try to do something. And I kind of like had in my late teens, early 20s, a kind of mantra of, it can sound quite odd, but the mantra was a carrot can become a torch. And by that, it's based on everything that happened to me in childhood, that one thing could become something else. Even if you imagine it, the journey of imagining the transformation of an object to something else is possible. If you can imagine it, then there's a possibility that you can create it, you can manifest it. If you can't manifest it, then there'll be several points of manifestation between those two points, which blossom and grow other concepts. So because of kind of having a playfulness and a fearlessness with technology, then I started to use tape recorders in other ways to capture sounds or things which were meaningful to me. And then there's a big gap. And that's because other things come into play in my life and still have a connection with sound and through sound, and then becoming a musician as well. So that kind of early embryonic planting for what I'm doing now was left to bubble, and it was left to grow by itself. And during the late 90s, I was in a band. I think everybody was, even if they didn't realize it, everybody was in a band in the late 90s. And that allowed me to kind of venture into the sound world in a way, but in a way that I felt was contrived and I would say decorative, for the purpose of it being an entertainment value, which was enjoyable, but didn't strike a chord for me as it was when I was 8 years old and I was taping the charts on a Sunday. Now, what's interesting about that actually is when I was taping the top 10 on a Sunday and editing out the voice of the DJ who was announcing the next song and a few trivial facts, is that time of night on a Sunday, my mother would do housework. And I wish I still had these recordings, but I used to record. We put the tape recorder next to the radio player because we couldn't afford one, the inbuilt one. So I had to invent ways around it. But whilst I was recording these kind of pop classics, my mother would be doing domestic kind of activities in the background, which obviously we picked up on the cassettes themselves. So when listening back to this, I had this weird polarity between quite exotic pop music, this other world, and this domesticated female activity, which resulted in vacuuming. That was the kind of steps up, you know, they'd be moving things around, dusting, then vacuuming. Now, what's interesting about these early recordings is that the vacuum itself would physically go nearer the tape recorder. So eventually, this white crushing slabs of noise would eradicate what I was recording. And for me, that was possibly the most sonically exciting thing I have ever heard in my life. That disappearance of melody and format and rationale to be completely obliterated by another action, which then eventually disappears and the melody resurfaces again. And I think that's made the biggest impact on my life in terms of composition and noise and valuing noise and seeing how powerful noise is as a tool. I forgot your question because I'm rambling.
No, it's fascinating stuff. I mean, what it's making me think about, I don't know whether you've ever thought about it in this way, is that obviously sound comes in waves. And what you seem to be describing is a kind of incident whereby all the waves become so mixed up that they become almost unintelligible, so that the intelligibility of the music is overcome by the, I suppose, is it white noise of the Hoover?
Yeah, so because of that power battle between those two elements, once everything reached the crescendo where the crossover point was the purest and the values were kind of balanced, was so exciting, but it allowed me to, I guess in some aspects meditate in terms of who I am. And by that, I don't mean kind of like a meditation of emptying by meditation. I mean, as a child, to be able to realize where I am at that point in that time through that sound crossing over. It's almost like a free falling of safety, or the moments where one of my favorite sensorial moments is if I go to drink liquid, which is clear, and think it's water, but it's lemonade. And my brain pulls every single atom of the universe apart until it can recognize what's going on. And that fraction, that split second, was the same experience of hearing the pop music and the white noise cross over. And that freedom of not having any boundaries, but feeling safe, is something which within my projects, for me, that can help vulnerability by creating a space which doesn't have a form or a pattern which could be instantly recognized. So some of the projects that I work in are quite avant-garde, but I'm fortunate to be able to work with individuals and organizations which can see beyond the experimental approach of it, and they realize actually there is a benefit to this approach.
That's really fascinating, and your emphasis on the absolute fine detail of sounds is terribly interesting. So I was listening to your collaboration with Male Soft and Calm, and it made me wonder, do you think sound has been neglected by us as a society? It seems as if the people who market goods are well aware of it, but are the rest of us, do we give it as much respect as perhaps we should?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question, and it's one which I think I'm constantly asking or approaching people with, because I think we have a pressure put on us in terms of allowing the sense of hearing to be secondary behind a kind of oculocentric experience, where we determine how we feel, or how we're told to feel, and how we're guided through means of visual stimulus. And because of that, then there's a disconnection with the sense of hearing, which might only come to play if the phone goes off or there is a ambulance going past the house and there's feels like there's a bubble which has been burst. And I think this has been played to the advantage of by corporations and by organizations to be able to fill that gap and manipulate that gap by offering the sense of hearing as something else, which is maybe less pure, and which maybe the motivation behind it is a little bit questionable. There's a fascinating book by Carol Bird called Nazi Soundscapes, and it's a study that she did of how the Third Reich utilized public sound to manipulate very subtly the thoughts and opinions of the German public, and how subtle in change, sonically, the architecture of that society was used and abused because of that. But some of the methods they employed are some of the methods that marketing techniques have now. So I think part of the work I do is a battle, and I think it's a battle to reclaim our own listening space back from it being manipulated for the purpose of a superstructure in a capitalist system, where we can use sound then to look at our well-being and reclaim that and empower each other in terms of to connect with sound and the power of sound.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You're making me think that I visit, or have visited in the past when we went anywhere, a number of fairly modern prisons where you can see the architects have paid attention to space and light, but almost as a consequence of their thinking around those issues, the the sound is terrible. It's like walking into a cooling tower, and you can barely talk to someone just across the table. Do you think if architects could be a bit more cued into sound, they might be able to produce more therapeutically inclined spaces? Do you do any work with architects?
I've got some friends who are in that trade, and we've had some fascinating subjects about. I've yet to work directly with an architect, and it's something I'd be very keen to do. A few years ago, I did have conversations about working with an architect to actually physically build a structure which reacted to emotional sound. So the walls actually changed shape, and we tried to build a system, but it was too far out really for us to hold on to that idea. But I think sonic reactive or thoughtful architectural design does happen, but it happens in terms of sound baffling and controlling sound in that way, to hide sound or to hide traffic. I think there's a lot of work to be done in terms of emotional architecture with the use of sound structure and how sound can be embedded into emphasizing well-being of a space. I mean, the way you talk about the water tower and the sound of prisons is one thing which really fascinates me. And Naomi and myself, we've had some brilliant chats about how we can break down the kind of barriers and erode the impact that non-sound has within that, because the soundscapes itself feed itself in a prison. So it's something which can be combated. We talked about actually using sound lasers, didn't we, Naomi, and putting directed pinpoint birdsong through the corridors to be able to control sound in a way that then allows that person to feel different within that space. But the more Soft and Calm project, again, was looking at working with an older generation of people in a specific geographic location and seeing their shopping habits compared when they were younger to their shopping habits now, and how sound and architecture has made an impact on there. So they liked, in the late 60s and 70s, going to the smaller shop, the bell ringing, the sound of the door, the sound of the shopkeeper getting things down, all that kind of soundscape fed the person who's recalling that information with well-being. And when they started talking about their modern day shopping habits 40 years later, they can't be in Asda, one of the big superstores, for the more than 15 minutes. They have to send their daughters or some family member to get the shopping, because sonically they cannot cope because of the billowing, echoing sounds and the activity and the action in there, and the way that building, especially in that kind of industry, kind of has shell-like structures, which is quite open. So the psychological aspects for people going in and spending time in shopping areas like that is damaged by the sound. I'm speaking against my own methods here, but if they were to employ a nicer kind of soundscape within the environment, then they would spend more time in there and they would sell more products. However, it seems to be a little bit the opposite direction in terms of just thinking how a quick build, a cheap build, can make a bigger place to open quicker, and therefore that seems to be a priority. So kind of sonic values and emotions are not really taken into consideration so much. A little bit was done in the late 50s with Muzak and that kind of lift elevator music and mood music, but it's nothing which has been really pushed in terms of deep-seated psychology and sonic architecture.
It really feels like it gets pretty much neglected, actually. I mean, share David's experience in working in hospital. You know, I worked at a hospital where we had a snazzy new build, and the building was beautiful and was light and airy, but again, it's kind of like the acoustics were absolutely shocking. And then I think going to work in prisons where the sound almost feels like an assault. So working in hospitals, there was a lot of attention to staff slamming doors, for instance, being reckless with letting that door slam really loudly, and the patients would tell you off for banging the door in their what's effectively their home. And then you go to a prison and it's just clanging and banging for big chunks of the day, and the people don't complain about that. That's just accepted, that that's part of the environment. So it's really,
it's the acceptance thing that I find really difficult in terms of what our rights are, whether in prison or out of prison. Do kind of the rights of your sonic space and sonic safety and health, and how that is not really challenged, or maybe it's challenged when, if my neighbour at 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning is kind of cutting a tree down, then all of a sudden it's okay to be able to make a complaint and there's noise abated kind of process to go through. But in terms of kind of public space and commercial space, that's something, and prison space is something which is not, it's not challenged. And it's something still I'm very keen on, you know, working within the justice sector in terms of how sound can change behaviour. I mean, Naomi, we've seen it when we've done workshops at the prison, and we've seen it when we was in that one room and we had the prisoners and the officers all with their eyes closed. And the officers at the back, first of all, was we're not closing our eyes. But there was a moment of pure safety because everybody was listening, and they were listening to the sound of a bird which was used on a sound laser, and I was making the sound of the bird fly around the room. And it's a beautiful, beautiful, I'll never, ever forget it. Just this room full of people with the prisoners who have, they're there for that specific reason for the action they've carried out. They're smiling with their eyes closed and their heads just moving along, following the sound of this bird. And they open up their eyes and they're still smiling. And some of the feedback afterwards, some of the participants and the were coming up to me and saying, thank you, that bird reminded me of my mum. I've not thought about my mum for like 3.5 weeks, 4 weeks. Thank you. And then wanting to hug me because of it. I'm not a magician. All I'm just doing is just presenting a sound in a way for them to benefit from. If that is as an impact within 5 minutes during a workshop, imagine some very carefully structured, robust research about how sound can help behaviour in vulnerable places like prisons, and how that could change behavioural patterns, and then the effect that has on the individuals, then the staff, then the community. I think it's something which is I'm very passionate about, and something I really want to pursue.
Absolutely, and it's such a shame we didn't manage to do that before the pandemic. But I think there's not also the sense of safety, but I also think it lends itself to playfulness, the use of sound. You know, there was a fascination and curiosity about these sounds and how you're managing to make these different, it sound like different birds were flying around the room and sweeping past your ears. And you know, we know that prisoners have very impoverished experiences of play early on in life, and I think there was something that was really playful about that workshop that enabled people to engage with, which was just beautiful. In terms of bird song, that brings us to the next point. One of the projects you focused on that really tried to enrich a place featured quite highly in the media. So this was a song garden that you created in a children's hospice, and I'm not going to attempt to pronounce the name, I'll let you do that. But that featured in a really beautiful documentary on Radio 4, which was called Names in the Sky, really moving. And I wondered if you could tell us a bit about this project.
Yeah, sure. It was working with children's hospice for children with limited life. The hospice is T. Haffen, and that's in Cardiff, well, over on Barry, actually. And I spent a lot of time chatting with Tracy Jones, who works at the hospice, in terms of some of my other works and how we could work together. And they have a ceremony, a memorial ceremony every year, where they have the names kind of like etched into stones, and they place the new stones with the children that died that year onto the stone pile. And they were thinking of how they could maybe revisit a memorial in terms of it being outside. And I've always been fascinated with song canaries and how birds can mimic either cars, or they used to, in the late 1800s, people used to buy them as pets so they would learn the latest piano kind of hits and then sing them. It's kind of like an organic MP3 player, a Victorian organic MP3 player. And I thought, what a wonderful idea if you could download sonic information onto a bird and it would learn it and it would reproduce it. I wonder if we could do that with names. I wonder if we could download names onto a bird. And of course, that's impossible. But as you remember, I said before, a carrot can become a torch. So the way about it is that we took every single name of the children for the past 30 years that had been opened, and we changed the names into Morse code. So we had a pattern to work with. Then we found out the month that the child died, and then we found out the corresponding bird which sang the strongest during that month, and then we assigned the bird to the child. So we had a set of data to work with. We had a bird to represent the child, and we had Morse code. Now, to make the bird sing, we then sampled the bird of the choice that we made, and then we, using computer programming, we replayed the Morse code of the name by using the bird. Eventually, we got the bird to sing the name of the child. And then we put the bird song in chronological order, starting from when the hospice opened. It's a project which is going to be, it's ongoing. It's been funded for 20 years into the future. Every year I get a new list and we add that to the sound file. What's interesting is eventually over time, I have a theory, and it may not be correct, but I'm still going to believe in it because it's important to believe in things. And the theory is that eventually the local birds will adapt their song to the sounds of these other birds. And eventually then you do have the idea of names being downloaded onto birds and birds singing the names in the skies of these children that have died. So it is a way to connect people with raw emotion, with loss, with nature, but also with hope, without it being in a religious connotation, of knowing that there is always hope.
It's such a moving story, and I really recommend to any listeners to check out the documentary on iPlayer, because that's definitely worth a listen. But something really special about birdsong, isn't there? I mean, you mentioned how captivated people were by birdsong within the prison, where of course it's harder to hear that. But you also used birdsong with residents of Lynewood Dementia Support Service. What do you think it is about birdsong that's so uplifting, do you think?
I think in terms of ourselves and how we're talked to by other things on which are alive on this planet, it's birds, it's us and then birds. And birds supply a backing track to emotional experiences, even when you're not aware of it. So when you're on the phone and you're arguing with your girlfriend, there's a bird singing. When you're with friends outside, you're having a conversation, there's birds singing. So there's this constant support, like a sonic blanket of everything that you've done in your life, which has been accompanied by a bird singing. And because of the patterns and melodies, I think quite similar in a way to the way that we speak, in terms of things being clipped and heightened and slowed down and consistent, I think we have a desire, an inbuilt desire to be connected with birdsong. And I think it's it's there for a purpose, and it's there for an emotional purpose. And it's not as if kind of like dogs barking all the time the same way as a, because that, if we think about that, this sounds like it'd be pretty horrific. Constant Alsatians barking at your house. But if you think of a robin sat outside just doing his thing, there's something which is extremely beautiful. And it's the thought of flight. It's the thought of freedom, the thought of sound which penetrates. Even though you can't see the birds as well, you can hear them. And it is a magical experience. And if you're in a car and you're driving through, you can also hear birds singing and not aware of them. Even if you're traveling 50 miles an hour, you will go past and a bird song will penetrate your car window. And I don't know really what the reason is why I'm fascinated with bird song, other than it's a magical otherworldly experience.
Absolutely. And another of the projects that I found inspirational to hear about was your project with the Royal Lifeboat Institution at the coast. And this, in fact, led to us collaborating together within the Fens unit. Can you tell us a bit about the original project?
Yeah, so that's the Echo Point project and late 2018, the RNLI had a series of questions that they wanted creatives to respond to. And the project was called Design Out Drowning. And it was looking at different means and methods of how the RNLI would need to get information out for coastal health and safety. One of the subject matters I was interested in was coastal mental health. And moving to Cornwall 3 years ago, I became very apparent, and I was quite surprised at it, but I was very naive about it, was the mental health in Cornwall and the suicide rates in Cornwall, especially on very beautiful points in the landscape. I didn't understand that connection between the act of suicide and the beautification of a spot where that happens. So an opportunity came up to work with the RNLI and to see for this Design Out Drowning initiative of how I could do an intervention which might help with such an issue. And I came up with a piece of work called Echo Point. And it was very simple in terms of its conception. It was asking a group of people, so one particular part in Cornwall, nine questions, and the nine questions were all focused around sound and which sounds makes you calm, which sounds makes you happy. And then visualizing all this response and all this data, and then narrowing them choices down to three sounds. And the reason why there was three sounds chosen is because it was then going to be embedded into a breathing exercise. And the breathing exercise was breathing in for 4 seconds, holding your breath for 7 seconds, and breathing out for 8 seconds. So each one of the sounds, popular sounds, which had been identified by the community, was then placed in sequence to this breathing activity. And then we tested the theory out. And it worked. So we were testing it out in surgeries on the coast in near Newquay and Perranporth, and we were working with NHS staff with extremely high agitation levels. And to test it out, we did measurements of heart rate, skin galvanization, stress levels, and we found that we were reducing stress in NHS staff in under 3 minutes by the use of focused breathing and deep listening. So because we found out it worked, then we went ahead and did a few tests, pilot tests. And the good news now is Cornwall Council use it for their towards suicides initiative. So we have these stickers that are going up in public places where people can scan and access the sound file, these little business cards which are appearing in coffee shops and pubs and things like that. And it's working. And the other kind of caveat to the original idea of the suicidal spot was having a bench which had the means to play that soundscape at a press of a button. So you can intervene with someone at a vulnerable time. You can extend dwell time for somebody so emergency services have a greater chance to get in contact with that person, and you can change behaviour. And so we had this bench which had the soundscape in it. It was solar powered and press of a button. It guides the person through the breathing and the listening exercise. So we did that initially, and then other places got involved. And that's where we did the really satisfying work with Naomi at the prison at HMP Whitemoor.
Absolutely amazing project. It's just unfortunate, obviously, for us that the delivery of that arrived during the pandemic. So it's difficult to give any feedback in relation to that. But I wondered how you'd found it coming in and working within the prison, because obviously you've spoken about how much the men engaged with you during the workshop, but that's not been the only venture that we've done with you, is it?
No.
The listening passports.
Yeah. I remember the first time I was in the prison, obviously my hearing was heightened and the focus was heightened in terms of metallic resonance, and that metallic resonance akin to protection and separation. So whether it was keys, doors, keys, bigger doors, smaller doors, locks, and the gaps in between each one is regimented. And I also recognised that coming through with the door checking, which also fascinated me. So there's these gaps of silence within this metallic sonic kind of architecture in the prisons, and these incremental points of silence or things stopping usually would have been associated for me with safety. However, in the prison, that wasn't the case, because every time there wasn't a metallic sound, it's because there was checking and observation and surveillance and for the potential threat. And it's the first time silence has been presented to me in a different, unique way. And I came out of our first meeting with, I was overwhelmed. I was very moved. I did sat in my car and I did cry, because I think it challenged me to rethink of who I think I am in regards to the actions of other people. It was a very moving experience, and I think that was the motivation for me to really reach out and want to connect with the men there in terms of having an impact with the projects that we were doing. So we had the Echo Point project, but then we also had the night migration project, the listening passport, and testing that in terms of isolation and sounds of prison, and how, rather than listening to those negative sounds or non-sounds in the prison environment, let's try and get the prisoners to reassess their sonic landscape and try for them to reassign value to sounds which they may not even considered of being of value to them. You know, there's a saying, isn't it? You never miss something until it's gone. And I think it's the same with sounds. So even if there might have been a sound of somebody snoring next to you for how long you've shared a cell with, when that snoring stops, then the sound stops, and then you realise, actually, I did find it annoying, but now that it's not there, the comfort's gone. So we created kind of a listening passport, which was an actual passport-sized document for prisoners to engage in that environment, to start logging down sounds which they heard and then assessing them. Oh, yeah, this one is positive for me. Oh, no, that one isn't. Oh, I didn't notice this one before, but I notice it now, and now I'm hearing it all the time. So it's a kind of like a buoyancy aid to allow the sense of hearing to navigate through the kind of the prison day in some respects, and then taking that information back and building a soundscape in reaction to the data that was given back to us. And also including that was poems as well. So it became a soundscape, it became a poetry book. The poems are absolutely phenomenal in terms of their rawness and how deep-seated they are in a human being's point of view in terms of sound.
It was a really fascinating experience. David, I wasn't sure whether you wanted to say something.
Well, I will say something, actually, just to take you back a little bit, because when you were describing the garden in Cardiff, which was very, very powerful indeed, it reminded me, and I think you said you weren't sure if the theory was true, but you imagined that the birds might pick up the sounds and begin to repeat them. And it reminded me of something I heard, and I don't know if it was in the middle of the night or something on television, but it was an account of how some birds had lived for many years besides a little petrol engine, which operated as a generator in these old mm-hmm. crofts, and they assimilated the sound of that popping engine. And what was even more interesting was that it became an inherited song. So it went through many generations.
Yeah, that's the work of Chris Watson. He's done some compelling and groundbreaking work in terms of sound and nature, and that idea of passing sound on is something which I wish we did as humans, and passing over an archive, passing over land, inheritance, passing something down because it's of value is something which we don't do with sound. There's many organisations that try and protect sounds and sounds that have disappeared and have gone. But in terms of handing something down to a younger generation is non-existent, because I think we feel that the generation before us sonically are in some respects stupid. And I've seen that myself, you know, when I was 15 years old and listening to Joy Division, wearing my massive German army coat and my big boots, walking around burning my Walkman on, thinking that, you know, that is the sound of me, that is the sound of now. It's not possible that anybody who's not my generation will understand that and don't deserve to understand that, because that is my tribal sonic space. And I can see it now when I work with young people, or even my own kids. There's that sonic generation gap, and it's something which it needs addressing, because I think we can learn so much from previous generation in terms of sound and the value of that sound and what the sound of that past world was. Because once that generation dies off, then the connection to that sonic world dies off as well with it. I mean, you can have film footage of things, but it's completely different for someone talking about how they grew up in Somerset and they used to walk along the cornfields and they could hear the heads of the cornfields rubbing against each other in the breeze, and it indicated that the weather had changed, or how that sound made an impact. And if you trace back sound and humanity, the further that you go back, the more important sound played a role in terms of sharing inheritance and generation. So it's something which has been robbed in modern man in terms of connectivity between intergenerations. And it's something which I try to address in my projects, that both young and old can share a sonic experience together and have value, but maintain that need to remain separate. Because I also understand that the younger generation wants its own sonic space, needs that sonic space, but there must be a means and ways to share that safely and learn from each other.
And you can see how musically that's you know, that is diminishing. So for instance, nowadays people buy their music, say, on Apple, but actually that music ends when you die. You don't get to nominate somebody to own your music, whereas in the past obviously people would have inherited their parents' vinyl or CDs or what have you, and that just won't happen. It will just stop with that person's death. So yeah, you can see that those connections musically will diminish over time.
Absolutely, and that's the danger of that, our kind of decoupling with the sense of hearing and who we are in terms of the loss of the physical object associated with that sound. And you know, quite rightly, you can't pass on MP3s, because it's zeros and ones on a hard disk. It necessarily doesn't exist, emotionally exists, but physically it doesn't. And there's a real danger. It's interesting that there's not been a new physical format since the kind of mini disc, which was just kind of like a smaller kind of CD kind of thing. But there's no one really pushed the boundaries in terms of how it was in the early days and the early sound. It's fascinating to learn about sound and format. If you have a look at how the crossover between silent cinema and when sound was introduced, the story behind that is fascinating in terms of even now, why we have 45 RPM and 33 is all related to the work that was done then. Nothing's been pushed. It's kind of resigned itself to, oh, that's an older format. We don't need the physical, because the physical takes up space. And if it takes up space, then it's unhealthy because it becomes clutter. And I think it's a conditioning that we have in terms of association with object and nostalgia, that we do need a new format to reconnect people with sound, I think. Mm. Maybe I need to invent one. Make a few notes.
Just again on that theme around prisoners, a sizable minority of prisoners seem to experience hyperacusis, you know, that heightened sensitivity to sound. So for instance, becoming increasingly irritated by people talking or whistling, pool balls clinking, but really in quite an irrational way, where they seem to really hear that sound when nobody else would even notice it. Is there anything that could be done to create a more calming environment for people whilst allowing for a richer environment for others? How do you get that kind of balance so that you don't have total silence, but you don't have people flooded?
Yeah, I think offering total silence is as complicated as offering sound and umbrella in kind of everybody in the same format. And the condition that you talk about is kind of like related to this misophonia of sounds which trigger fear or anger instantaneously. There's a lot of research done about eating habits and how family members can trigger extreme anger by the sound of, you know, the father chewing. When the person's chewing themselves, it doesn't trigger it off, but it's somebody else doing it. So it's that connection with the sound. I'm interested in how architecture, as I said before, can be used to change sound or direction of sounds, or the use of sound lasers so it doesn't become something which is covered over everything, but located specific points people can go to or go through, kind of like a sound shower kind of experience, to be able to switch on and off kind of emotionally connection with it. Or even doing some work round about what sounds are identified as being triggers for negativity. I have a theory that I've not had chance to work on yet. It'd be fantastic to be able to carry it out somehow. But every sound has a frequency or a key. So, you know, if it's the car slamming the brakes on, then you can maybe say, oh, that's an A sharp, for example. Now, the thing about sound is if there is a sound, there's also a counter sound. And I thought about developing a sound system which notifies the sounds which are having a negative impact in someone's life and then seeing what the corresponding note is. So it's kind of like a complete opposite melody to the melody which is affecting the individual. It's something I've been wanting to do for a couple of years now, and seeing there's a theory just boiling in the back of my mind in terms of it being very achievable and very quickly, and something which even can be taught on a piano or even a small ukulele or something, which becomes a audio signature or a safe signature where these things happen, then notes can be then played or accessed in that way. And you don't have to be a musician to be able to carry out this. You just need to know, oh, my five sounds which trigger me are these notes, D, E, F, G, A minor. What's the corresponding notes which cancel that out? That's the antithesis of that, and turning a fearful melody into a hopeful one.
So creative, Justin.
Well, I would love to do that. So if you want to work on it, let me know.
So that sounds a bit similar to what Wagner did in the Ring Cycle with his motifs. So they'd sometimes be that side up and they'd sometimes be the other side down, depending on the particular mood that was going to be associated with it. Anyway, absolutely fascinating stuff, Justin. We come to the last question, or my last question at any rate. I believe you turned your creative energies to mining another perhaps underappreciated sense, the sense of smell. So would you like to tell us something about this project?
Yeah, so this was a new, this was me going out of my comfort zone as a sound artist to start working in the sense of smell. And it's a reaction to the idea of, I was walking around and having people with masks on, their face covered, and how our senses in lockdown have changed, and how what we used to access used to be good for us. And the sense of touch, you know, we can't touch things, and if we do, we have to wash our hands. We can't breathe these things in. Anything that had that kind of connection became quite demonized. And the sense of smell, for me, I thought, is becoming demonized. And going back to my childhood, one of the things I used to love doing when I got a comic is actually, Paul's a comic out here. This is a Norwegian comic, by the way. Is to smell the paper and the print. And it's something I would do in bookshops. I would do it at school. I would do it at my grandmother's house. And I thought, I wonder if anyone else sniffs books, because I do it all the time. I cannot be the only one that sniffs books. So these things coming together about the sense of smell being demonized, people's faces being covered, then I thought, because we're in lockdown, it's great to have a sense of belonging, because community is challenged at the moment. It's difficult for people to feel that they belong. One of the great things about being a child is being in a club and the idea of being associated with something. So we came up with the book sniffing club, and I was very surprised at how quickly it took off, and the interest that it took on board was great. So instead of people having pictures of themselves with their masks on, they had the picture of their books. And we built an online resource where people could go through guided instructions and they could type in their smell notes to the books. It puts that into a digital library that you can then flick and pull down and look what other people have written about that book. And then we did some workshops with people where we're doing mass book sniffing classes, which were great, you know, a great well-being resource. And we developed So we came up with something which is the World Book Sniffing Day, which was the 12th of December. And we sent out these bookmarks with instructions on the back of how to sniff a book. And our champions then received, I'll send you both when I've got some left. These are quite cool that we had these badges made up.
Oh yes, that'd be excellent.
So you actually belong to a club. You got the kit, you're in the club, and then people were sending out social media, responding to it. And we had people from all over the world just submitting. The World Book Sniffing Day was really popular. It extended now. So now there's an academic team from UCLA interested in doing a study using the Book Sniffing Club. I've been invited to Barcelona to do some book sniffing workshops. And it's just something that everybody gets because they'll say, do you know what? I do sniff books, but I never told anybody. It was nice that we could share this thing together. And that sense of safety and not feeling that you're a bit of a freak because you like smelling books. And then we did interviews with people as well, which became a radio series called Sniff and Tell. I'm trying to get the BBC to commission just 2 minutes during the day where you just have someone smelling a book and saying what it reminds them of. Just a little kind of, again, breaking that bubble in terms of, oh, you're listening. Your ears are connected. It's about the healthy distraction. So, we'll probably be thinking about World Book Sniffing Day 2 for next year, or this year in December. We'll see how that goes. But it proved to be a very, very popular project, and one which I stepped out of my comfort zone. I was quite fearful of it. The next thing I'm tempted to do is weaving. I think that might be one of the next projects I attempt.
I think you've got a lot to explore there in the sniffing business. It reminded me of, I took the kids to an open day at Didcot Power Station quite a number of years back when it was still open, and which is where my experience of the cooling tower came from. But also we went into a workshop where they used to drill metals and cut metals. And it took me right back to when I was a kid and my dad took me to the factory that he worked in North London, which was a metal working factory. And it was that smell of slightly burning oil, which really caught me and took me back 50 years or more. So I think smell is a powerful, evocative sense.
Mm. It's just difficult to harness. So the project with the Department of the Heritage of Smell, that's what they actually call it. It's an academic there. We're talking about trying to recreate the smell of memories for people to have. So you can emulate smell, but the thing about it, you can't emulate it as powerful as you can emulate something with sound, because smell is so complicated and there's so many molecules and timings and things involved with it. And if you get it slightly wrong, you've completely shattered the illusion. So it's a difficult beast, but it's an interesting area, one I'm curious on learning more about.
You can certainly see the overlap with what you do as well but Justin, at the end we normally ask people about something that they found nourishing, and it seems to me that your entire career really and your artistic endeavours has been about trying to find ways to create nourishment or uplift, capture things in a way that's emotionally very powerful and meaningful. But I wonder if there's anything that you would particularly want to mention as something that you personally found uplifting or nourishing.
Good question. I think the most uplifting and nourishing thing is to be brutally honest with yourself and challenge that and challenge the pattern of who you are and why you do things, and not to fall into a regimented way of being, of, oh, I do that because that's what I'm like, and I know what I like, and I like what I know. And I think that unhelpful version of ourselves doesn't allow for that nourishment and growth. So I think that's what I do with my work. I think I put myself in a position where I'm challenged and working in challenging environments, you know, working in prisons, working in dementia homes, working in care homes, children's homes where their children are dying, or like the Remembering Baby Project, working with parents who had literally lost a baby within an hour. Them kind of environments which are hyper raw and very real, to be able to work or see life in that way also becomes nourishing, of not wanting just to be able to draw a circle and then think, oh, I'm great at drawing circles, I'm going to draw circles all my life. Because then there's no progression made, or there's no movement in terms of a map, or literally you've still got that snowball covered in snow and you've not realized there's a stone inside it.
They're really wise words, but it's certainly something that you do absolutely embody. I mean, I said at the start that never know how a conversation with you is going to go, Justin, because you have so many different interests or things that take you in a different direction. So, you know, really fabulous, really entertaining conversation today, but also full of things that are really interesting and really moving. So thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me, guys. It's been lovely.
Yeah, it's been a great pleasure to meet you, and really enjoyed the conversation we've just had.
That was good, wasn't it?
That was fantastic. I really enjoyed that. And as you said beforehand to me, Justin's a really interesting thinker, and you never can be quite sure where you're going to go in your discussion with him.
Absolutely. I just think he's so innovative in terms of his thinking, and he'll present something in conversation that's, to start off with, seems quite random, and then before you know it, it's actually into something that's really rich and has got a lot of therapeutic potential. And I think really sees things in quite a deep way. So yeah, hopefully there'll be more opportunities to hear about his work in the future.
Yep. Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com. and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.